supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Bobby Allen, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller's off this evening. There is a correctional officer problem in Delaware. More and more people are quitting their jobs, guarding prisons, and the state's having trouble hiring new ones. As a result, the workforce is facing mandatory overtime, and that's sapping morale and adding stress to the men and women responsible for keeping prisons safe. But as WHYY's Chris Barish has learned, Governor John Carney's administration is now considering a bold move, moving hundreds of high-security prison inmates out of state to alleviate the crisis.
Currently, one in seven prison guard jobs is vacant, the highest rate in years. Delaware is having this problem even after increasing correctional officers' starting salary to $43,000 and offering signing and retention bonuses. The shortage was partly to blame for a 2017 uprising that killed a guard. With the vacancy rate showing no signs of improving substantially, officials are mulling the last resort option of transferring prisoners out of Delaware. Correctional spokeswoman Jamie Gravel says they would come from the medium maximum security unit, which houses up to 600 inmates.
So it hasn't been decided that we're definitely moving anybody, but that is an idea that was thrown out there, among others, that is being considered. They're not in stone yet.
State Representative James J.J. Johnson says he heard the number being considered is 500 inmates, so he contacted Prisons Commissioner Perry Phelps.
He said they haven't finalized the plan yet. They said it wouldn't be no more than a couple of hundred. Well, the good thing about it, a positive thing, will be giving some relief to the current correction officers.
The Reverend Chris Bullock, who chairs the Delaware Coalition for Prison Reform and Justice, says he has heard yet another number. He worries about how being far away will cut off families who want to visit.
One thing did come to mind immediately was the impact it would have on families if these inmates are moved, I heard, to Pennsylvania. If they don't have access to their families in terms of support and in terms of just staying in touch with them, it would have an adverse effect on their reentry possibilities if they are close to being released.
Governor Carney's office says he's committed to reducing Delaware's prison population and will announce his decision this fall. From the Delaware desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
Philadelphia courts are making millions of dollars from poor criminal defendants. Journalist Mara Ewing has been reporting on the fees defendants have to pay, even if they're proven to be innocent, and a growing movement to reform the practice. It's part of the Broken Philly Reporting Collaborative, which includes WHYY and more than a dozen other news organizations. Mara, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So your story starts out with the case of this guy, Wayne Stiles. He's a 52-year-old Philadelphia security guard who was wrongfully arrested last year after being pulled over for having tinted windows. Pick up the story from there.
Yeah, so Stiles was booked for illegal possession of a firearm. Meanwhile, he was slammed with a $25,000 bail. His friend paid 10%, and he was out free. After the first court hearing, the case fell apart. So the case is finished, and this is the point where the defendant usually gets their bail money back. But Stiles, like every other defendant in Philadelphia, got his money back minus 30%. So in this case, that was $750 retained by the court. This fee is called a bail processing fee, and last year it generated $2.9 million for the city's general fund.
Wow, so nearly $3 million for the city. And to be clear, even someone like Stiles, who is innocent, is being assessed these so-called bail processing fees, right?
Yes.
And in your story, legal experts call this, quote, a fee for access to justice. And it's fair to say it's almost a hidden fee, right? Because most defendants don't even know about it. And so I'm wondering, are city leaders now giving this a hard look?
They are, yeah. So as city top officials are examining the cash bail system as a whole and implementing reforms such as District Attorney Larry Krasner's move away from it, this fee came to their attention. Currently, there are ongoing discussions about eliminating it.
Your story highlights other court fines and costs. So this 30% bail fee is really part of a larger picture here, right? There are many other charges. Some critics call them taxes, even, on people for just moving through the local criminal justice system. Can you talk about that?
So at the end of a trial that ends a conviction, or if someone takes a plea deal, as is most common, they are handed a bill that is essentially for how much the trial cost. In Philadelphia, the tallies range from $200 to sometimes over $1,000. And that money goes to running the courts, and it also goes into city and state coffers.
When did these fees start, and has local government become dependent on them?
It's hard to say how dependent local government has become on them, but it certainly generated a revenue stream in the tens of millions of dollars that would be hard to replace. And it wasn't always like this. This source of revenue was catalyzed in the early 1990s when we, as a country, not just in Philadelphia or in Pennsylvania, poured more money into cops and prosecution. So many more people were getting arrested and prosecuted, but the courts weren't adequately funded to keep up with this, resulting in huge backlogs and just not enough resources to properly run the court system. So they turned to defendants to actually foot the cost of the trials. In some jurisdictions, not in Philadelphia, people even pay for their time in jail as if it were a hotel or something.
Wow. So poor people who get caught up in the criminal justice system, when they do finally gain their freedom and, you know, they're starting to rebuild their lives, they're often holding this big bill to the court system. I mean, have experts you've talked to said anything about the impact that has on their lives?
Yeah, it can have a big impact, especially if they can't pay. One public defender I talked with said about 40% of her clients would fit into that category. So getting handed this bill oftentimes sends them into a spiral of debt. In Philadelphia, after 2 years of the debt isn't paid, it's increased by 25% because it's handed off to a private collection agency. Meanwhile, that person can't have their record expunged, so employers and landlords can still see it, making it difficult to get a job, get an apartment, access to higher education. All of the elements that contribute to what we would see as a stable life that would help a person earn money to pay off that debt.
And so this isn't just a Philadelphia problem. This is happening around the country, right? Has there been a movement against it in other places? And how about here in Philadelphia?
So it's absolutely a national problem. Increasingly, a small number of jurisdictions around the country are beginning to assess a person's ability to pay before they impose this debt. So judges can assess a person's financial circumstances and waive or reduce the debt based on that. In Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania, judges do have the discretion to do that by law, but in practice, it's never done. And actually, the Philadelphia Inquirer wrote an editorial today suggesting that the city start to do that.
Yeah, and so judges aren't doing it probably because they don't even know that it's within their discretion, right? It's just not sort of part of the conversation among judges.
Absolutely. That's a great point. This isn't incompetence at any point. This is, judges actually don't know that it's in their discretion. It is a statute that's been obscured over the years. It was sort of rediscovered, I guess, by an ACLU lawyer. Mm-hmm. But the law says very clearly, a law written in 2010 sort of eliminates any confusion that judges can impose the full amount, but they're not mandated to. They can impose it based on how much a person can pay.
As you mentioned, Maura, the Philadelphia Inquirer today, their editorial board said, you know, as the city invests in programs to fight poverty, because remember, Philadelphia is the poorest big city in America, and also, you know, with Krasner and other city leaders starts to take steps to reform the local criminal justice system, the most logical step, according to the editorial board, to further those goals would be to scrap excessive fines and fees altogether. So we will be following this as it unfolds. But thank you, Maura Ewing, for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Maura Ewing, a Philadelphia-based independent journalist. Countries like China and Vietnam have a message for America. We want less of your recycling. The tightening global market for recycling is creating both a national problem for the U.S. and a curbside problem across Pennsylvania. The Allegheny Front's Kara Hopsopple has more.
If you're like me, the recycling you drag to the curb outside your house for pickup includes cans, sales flyers, soda bottles, yogurt tubs, and the clamshells that raspberries and strawberries are packaged in. I put a lot of those in the blue bin. But that's about to change.
For us, it's business as usual. We're taking everything today that we took last year.
That's Sean Weigel, Program Supervisor of Environmental Services for the City of Pittsburgh. He means the usual glass, paper, metal cans, and plastics with the numbers 1 through 5 and 7 on the container. You know, the number inside the little triangle. But
the numbers, we're going to be probably getting away from those in the near future. They're just confusing.
That's because not all plastic is created equal. The number on the bottom of that strawberry container is number one. That's PET, or polyethylene terephthalate. It's also a type of plastic soda and water bottles are made from, but those bottles are a lot more valuable than food containers. Bottles can be cleaned and melted down to make more bottles, or other products like carpets or park benches. That's not what happens to many other shapes and numbers of plastics. Erica Young and I are wearing hard hats and watching a parade of bottles and bags. They're moving on a belt from a pile three times our height to a platform where they're sorted by hand.
These bays here below the line are our residue bays, so all of that material in there is going to end up at the landfill.
We're just outside of the tipping floor of Waste Management's MRF, or Materials Recovery Facility, on Neville Island near Pittsburgh. 10,000 tons of material come through here each month. They have recycling contracts with businesses and municipalities in the region. Workers pick out stuff that could hurt the machines, materials that can't be recycled, like garden hoses. We even see a bowling ball.
Your strawberry clamshells might not be in this refuse pile, but before they get to the end baling, they will probably end up in a refuse pile.
Young says later on down the line, the cardboard and paper material are sorted with a sizing screen. The paper rolls over the top because it's flat. But those flimsy plastic berry containers also fold flat.
So it's going to roll over top and it eventually could end up with the paper as well.
She says that's contamination. Until last year, a lot of plastic and paper recycling was sold from facilities like this one to China. But at the beginning of the year, China stopped importing most plastic waste and mixed paper, like junk mail. It has its own trash problems, and China will only accept a prohibitively low amount of contamination in the materials it still takes. That leaves sorting facilities with few options.
If we don't have a market to sell this material to, it essentially isn't a recyclable.
So strawberry containers and yogurt cups have to come out of the waste stream. Even glass has a contamination problem, because in a single stream facility, bottle caps and other small items get mixed up with it. Young says Waste Management is trying to get the word out to its customers, those municipalities, that it really only wants paper, cans, and those plastic jars, jugs, and bottles with a narrower top, which they can still sell. Anne Germain is with the National Waste and Recycling Association.
We understand why China is doing this, but the timeline that they set for it was so short, though it didn't allow for alternative markets to develop.
Germain says even the alternative markets in Asia, Vietnam and Thailand, are turning away foreign recycling because they're overwhelmed with the surplus. And building similar facilities in the U.S. will take time and investment. Justin Stockdale is Western Regional Director of Pennsylvania Resources Council, a statewide environmental group. He says he doesn't want people to be discouraged by all of this. Stockdale says recycling still works, but it's a commodity, not just a way to deal with our trash.
And I think we need to think about this as an opportunity to get it right and to do better.
And as Stockdale reminds me, recycling is only one of the R's. Reduce and reuse are even more critical now, while the world market is in flux. So I could go to the farmer's market with my own container to buy strawberries, or get creative with how to reuse that plastic clamshell. I'm taking suggestions. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Kara Holzapfel.
An explosive grand jury report released Tuesday documents the sexual abuse of more than 1,000 children by some 300 priests in Pennsylvania, stretching back to the 1940s. The report has intensified calls for law changes and other accountability measures. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller spoke with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll, to gain a better understanding of America's Catholic demographic.
Frank, to the extent that accountability comes from the top, in what regard is Pope Francis held, first by Catholics specifically and then the general public?
Well, we just finished updating Americans' opinions of Pope Francis, an interviewing that ended on Sunday, the 12th of August, so it was just before this report was released. Among Catholics, a very positive image, 79% favorable, but 12% unfavorable. But that's not uncommon. Some Catholics usually have, a small percent of Catholics have an unfavorable opinion of most popes. And then when you look at all Americans, 66% favorable, 17% unfavorable, and that leaves a higher percent of all Americans who don't have an opinion either way. But all in all, Pope Francis, a quite positive image among both Catholics and the average American.
Let's drill down on the demographics, starting with our tri-state region regarding representation by Catholics.
Yeah, it's very interesting because a lot of people that I talk to think, you know, there are a lot of Catholics in all states of the Union, but that's not the case. There is a huge disparity in the percent of the population that is Catholic across the states of the Union. Let me give you the extremes. Rhode Island has the highest percent of Catholics of any state in the Union. 44% of all Rhode Island adults are Catholic, higher than Protestants or any other denomination. And then you go all the way down to Alabama, and only 6% of residents of Alabama are Catholics, and that has the lowest percent Catholic of any state in the Union. Overall, right now, it's about 22.5% of Americans are Catholics. And back to your question about the tri-state region, New Jersey has the second highest percent of Catholics of any state in the Union, just behind Rhode Island. 40% of residents in New Jersey are Catholics. You come down to Pennsylvania, it's 11th. With 28% Catholic population. And then Delaware's a little less Catholic, but still above average. Our estimation is that 26% of adult residents in Delaware are Roman Catholic.
And again, across the country, 22%?
22.5%. And what's interesting is that hasn't changed a lot over the decades. The percent of Americans who are Protestant, which is now 48%, has dropped dramatically. We had times decades ago where three-quarters of Americans identified as Protestants or with a non-Catholic Christian faith, but as the percent of nuns, N-O-N-E-S, percent of Americans that don't have religious identification has gone up, that has mainly come out of Protestants, and the percent of Protestants has fallen dramatically, but the percentage of Catholics in this range, 22 to 25%, has been pretty constant. Why? Well, one of the big reasons is the in-migration of Hispanics, the majority of whom bring a Catholic faith with them over the years. So that's helped keep the percentage of Americans who are Catholic fairly steady, while other religions have been falling as a percent of the population.
Frank, the opioid epidemic shows no signs of abating. In fact, the New York Times reported that there were a record 72,000 overdose deaths across the country last year. At this juncture, what percent of families report a relative who's had trouble with drugs?
30%. And that is up significantly. We've asked that question over the years off and on, and back in 1999, not that long ago, that percentage was only 17%. And when we last asked this, which was about 10, 12 years ago, it was 22%. So that 30%, although of course not a majority, which is always good news, is up from where it has been. And in absolute numbers, if 30% of us have issues with drug abuse somewhere in our family, that's a major issue, as you mentioned, the headlines are showing.
Contrast that with disclosure about a family member who has issues with alcohol.
37% of Americans say that drinking has been a cause of trouble in their family over time, and that's been up some, although steadier than the percent who say that drug abuse has been a problem in their family. So even at this point in time, alcohol still is at least slightly more of a problem among American families than drug abuse.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
The Middletown Grange Fair in Bucks County turns 70 years old this weekend. For WHYY News, Kyrie Greenberg talks to the fair's youngest farmhands keeping agricultural traditions alive as they prepare to show off their pigs, cows, and chickens.
Olivia Davis Egan is 14 and getting ready to show a Holstein cow in the dairy competition, but she lives in the suburbs. 4-H helped her partner with a dairy farm for the past 6 months and learn how to train and take care of a calf. At the fair, Egan says she sees herself as a farm educator.
There are people that walk through and, like, they've never really seen a cow or a sheep or a chicken or a pig or whatever up close before, and they have no idea where their food comes from. And I think that that's something that's, like, gotten away from most people, and I think it's important for them to come here and kind of learn about that.
Her friend Jess Durbin also leases a calf from Curly Hill Dairy in Plumsteadville, and says she was surprised at how many people seem to believe an old joke.
The thing we hear a lot from people is that the brown cows make chocolate milk, or, like, these ones make strawberry, like, pink milk. So the true fact is all cows make white milk.
Middletown's Grange Fair started as a way for farmers to compete in a national corn-growing competition and is now a 5-day event that hosts thousands. For 4-H'ers, it's the first round of shows on the road to the state fair. Kate Dangler is from Upper Black Eddy and says it's a great time to meet farm animals up close, because they've never been cleaner.
They have to be bathed constantly. That's why we sleep here overnight, so that we can be with them and take care of them more.
7-year-old Christian Frank says his family, who lives in Morrisville, has 6 chickens in their backyard.
One of the chickens yesterday, she sat down in my lap and laid an egg there. Her name was Barbie.
His twin brother Scotty says they both want to be in 4-H so their chickens can win ribbons.
But we have to wait until next year because we're not old enough this year.
The Grange Fair runs through Sunday. For WHYY News, Kyrie Greenberg.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. We had production assistance this week from Edward Shakisvili. The news director is Eugene Sun. Our assistant news director is Katie Colinari. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineers this week were Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, Adam Stanishevsky, and Mike Villers. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Bobby Allen for NewsWorks Tonight.